Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming on this cold Tuesday evening. I was very happy to be asked to reflect on Luke Howard and his naming of clouds, because the book has been out for 10 years now. This is the second edition that I put up on the screen, which is very slightly different from the first edition, which came out 10 years ago. And I've discovered that when you work on something, particularly on someone, you begin by following them around for a bit, and then once the thing has come out, it starts following you. And that's certainly been the case with Luke Howard. It's not been the case with other things that I've written. It tells the story, the book tells the story of Luke Howard, a shy Quaker pharmacist who, in 1802, at the age of 30, in an evening lecture, in a place not dissimilar to this, actually, it was a basement laboratory in Plough Court in London, it was full of scientific instruments, and he was a member of an amateur science club, and the rules of the club were that once a month you had to give a talk when your turn came round, or face a fine. And instead of paying the fine, Luke Howard decided to, at the last minute, put together a lot of observations and ideas he had about clouds and weather over many years since he was a child. And he gave this talk in December 1802 to this amateur science club, most of whom were young Quaker or other dissenters, men and women who were not allowed to attend either or any of the universities in Britain, and who effectively created their own polytechnic that they called the Aspasian Society, and they met in this basement. And in December 1802, Luke Howard gave this talk, which he called On the Modifications of Clouds. And as I describe in the book, using every cliche available, little did he know that this was going to completely transform not only his life, but the way that we understand the weather as a system. Now, Howard had this very simple but penetrating idea that although there are many types and shapes of cloud, there are only very few basic forms. In fact, he claimed that there were only three basic forms, cumulus, cirrus, and stratus, that he named from already existing Latin terms. So cumulus from cumulate, pile, the same word we get accumulate from. Cirrus from the Latin for hair or curl or tuft, and stratus in the Latin for sheet. Now this looks like a lake, but in fact it's a low-lying bank of fog or mist, as a stratus. So, sheets, layers, tufts, this was his major insight. Now the clever bit, and I'll come back to this later in the talk, I'm responding to Stephen's invitation to reflect on how this book came about and my own interest came about. But the really clever bit, which I'll come back to, is the way that all clouds of whatever modification, whatever type, are essentially either a transitional form, compound form, some form of modification of one of these three major families. But I'll hold that thought just for a moment, because I just want to say a little bit about how the book came about, as well as something on the particular pleasures and challenges of writing and reading scientific biography, or not quite biography in this case, as it's not so much a standard grandma to grave biography, but much more about the cultural, social, scientific impact of the naming of clouds in the 19th century and what that meant to Howard's contemporaries. So the book had its very first inkling origins in the end of 1997, and I was in a waiting room and there was an abandoned auction catalogue in the waiting room. So I picked it up for a book sale at Phillips Auctioneers, which no longer exists, it was bought by Bonhams. And it's funny, I tracked down this, I didn't keep it, but I've tracked this down. I went to Bonham's archives a couple of weeks ago And I knew the kind of the dates it was. And so it didn't take very long to find. And it's really, it's seeing it again after the interval of time really brings home to me how it was Luke Howard's voice on the page that I really responded to. Because what was for sale was a book. It was a copy of Howard's classic work, The Climate of London. Inside the book was a letter. I was less interested in the book and very interested in this letter, because what the letter does, it brings this voice alive. Here's suddenly a voice on the page that someone I'd never heard of. And I really liked the letter. And it's a letter to his grandson describing a water spout, or actually, not a water spout, but a funnel cloud. I'll show you a picture of a funnel cloud. It's an accessory cloud. Meteorologists call this a tuba. And it forms at the base of the cumulonimbus storm cloud, and you get a kind of revolving thing starts happening, and a lot of ambient moisture gets condensed into water droplets, which become visible. The whole thing starts descending towards the ground. Now, in cold weather climates like Britain and Europe, they very rarely make contact, or if they do, it's a weak water spout or land spout, never the full tornadic ferocity that you get in warm weather situations such as the American plains. So I think from the description that Howard gave in this letter, what he was describing was a funnel cloud, not a water spout. But I just love this letter. I thought I'd read you the letter and say something about it, because it's so wonderfully well observed. It's dated 17th of July, 1851, noon. It reads, "My dear Dilworth," his grandson, "we've been entertained within this hour past by the appearance of that very rare phenomenon, the waterspout. The clouds were heavy to the west and northwest with rain behind them, when one pretty much in advance of the shower let down the usual jelly bag, as the women very aptly described it." So it's a family group. Interesting social history. "But only about halfway to the earth, and not being over any water, as I conclude, there was no reaction we could perceive from beneath." So it's a funnel cloud. The letter went on to discuss the role of electrical phenomena in producing this kind of thing, which is one of Luke Howard's pet theories that he applied to all through his life, to every weather phenomenon he could, with varying degrees of success. But he ended the description by imagining if the funnel had come all the way down to the water. He ends by saying, "And then indeed, as a poet might say, 'tis Neptune shaking hands with Jove." I really liked it. I didn't appreciate at the time that Luke Howard was nearly 80 when he wrote this letter. But here we have this vibrant, vigorous, speaking voice on the page. And it's so spontaneous. I mean, it's literally spontaneous, written within an hour of the event it describes. It's so immediate. And here, as I keep saying, is this living voice on the page. And after reading this catalogue entry, with, I don't know if you noticed on the previous slide, this enticing mention at the bottom of the naming of clouds, that just set something off in my head. I mean, I'd recently completed a PhD in history of science, and I'd published one academic, very boring academic article about early volcano science, and I'd published a couple of really, even more boring book reviews, and I was doing lots of really badly paid hourly teaching. What I really wanted to do was write a book, not the book of the thesis, right? Because the idea of going back to spending a year rewriting a doctoral thesis was, as a friend of mine described it, like a dog returning to its vomit. Absolutely right. Some laughter of recognition. Yes, that was a very depressing idea. So I was actively looking for a new idea, a new subject. And this somehow clicked. You know, it just felt right. This was something interesting. So I thought I would do a bit of research on it. Now, in those days, if you wanted to find out about something, you had to go to a library to find out. This was 1997. This is a year before Google was even thought of, you know, before Professor Google turned up, you know, like some pub bore, pretending to know everything. But if you wanted to know something, wanted to know something in detail, you had to actually go to a library to look it up. I tell my students this now, and they look at me with incredulity. Like I told them that my first bicycle was a penny farthing. So I spent a couple of Saturdays in the British Library looking at Howard's DNB entry, reading his, I read a bit of his Climate of London, I read his essay on the modifications of clouds, and most importantly, checking that nobody had written a book about him before, which to my surprise, no one had. He was mentioned in a couple of other books, he was mentioned in a few articles, but there was nothing substantial about him. And it really didn't take very long before I thought I'd found a likely subject. Now, one of the things that I really liked, that I discovered very early, was Howard's connection, albeit fairly tangential, with a whole series of major cultural and scientific figures of his time, including Constable, who was directly influenced by Howard's classification of clouds, his essay on the modification of clouds. Now, we know that Constable was influenced because he owned a copy of Howard's essay and he wrote all over it. It was heavily annotated. It's one of the most heavily annotated items in Constable's book collection. Not always legibly. There's one really thing, he underlines the word cumulus and he writes in the margin, "No, it's a..." and it's illegible. And I'm determined somehow, you know, if it takes Bletchley Park to work this out. But it's this idea of the great sort of landscape painter. And reading a piece of very recent science, popular science. And I discovered that in the 1820s, this is when, presumably when Constable first read the essay, he spent two summers up on Hampstead Heath painting nothing but clouds, very rapid sketches. None of them took more than an hour. And he annotated them on the back with weather conditions, time of day, date, and so on. There's a wonderful example in the Ashmolean. Some of you might know. I went and paid homage to it this afternoon. And if you look really closely, you can see the little pinpricks in the corner of the paper. It's oil sketch on paper. And he had a box, painting box, which he took with him on his back. And then he sat down, opened the lid of the box, pinned the paper onto the inside of this, and sketched in oils very quickly. And then he would, once it was dry, he would then put all the information on, which is why there are so many mistakes in his information, because it was usually the next day that he wrote it in. But the lovely image, and this became a kind of establishing image for the book, was I discovered that Luke Howard lived in Plaistow and Constable was up on Hampstead Heath often on the same days. And Howard kept daily weather observations twice a day, every day, and he was a complete weather obsessive. And Howard and Constable were looking up and recording and responding to the same skies at the same days, only 8 miles apart. And that to me just became such a fantastic image of this, you know, this great scientist, this as yet unknown scientist, but a great scientific figure and a great artist, responding in their own way, attempting to understand the same passing clouds on the same day, but the sort of dates and times completely correlate. Fantastic image. And I would, when people asked me what I was working on, I would always tell them this image. People would always say, "Wow," which is always a good sign. If you're working on something, you tell people, they say, "Wow. I think it's a good sign you're onto something interesting." The worst thing is when they say, "Oh, that sounds really interesting." Which you know is a death knell for your ideas. But Constable took his weather studies very seriously. And he said something very interesting. "We see nothing truly till we understand it. We see nothing truly till we understand it. Painting is a science," he wrote, "and should be pursued as an inquiry into the laws of nature. Why then may not a landscape be considered as a branch of natural philosophy, of which pictures are the experiment?" Isn't that an interesting thing to say? And it kind of reminds us that this is a period when the arts and the sciences had yet to go their separate ways. And I think this is one of the leitmotifs of this talk. If this talk is about anything, it's about this relationship between the arts and the sciences and its slow separation over the centuries. But if only they'd met, you know, there's no evidence that Howard and Constable, even though they often were in the same, sometimes in the same building, they both used to go to lectures at the Royal Society and at the Royal Institution on Habermas Street. In fact, Constable gave lectures on clouds and weather at the Royal Institution, and we know that Howard attended the Royal Institution, but there's no evidence that they met. I did toy with the idea of writing an imaginary conversation between them, rather than the manner of Peter Ackroyd in his great biography of Dickens. I don't know if anyone has had the nerve to tackle this book. It's 1,200 pages long, but it has these sort of interludes where Dickens talks to his characters, and at one point Peter Ackroyd, the biographer, talks to his subject. It's interesting. They're set typographically distinct and apart from the main body of the text, so the reader isn't fooled into thinking this is historical actuality. I did toy with that idea, and then I thought better of it. But there were many other cultural and scientific personalities who peppered the book, and I'll maybe talk a bit about them when I come to them, Shelley, Goethe, and so on. Now, I'd already decided that I didn't want to write an academic monograph on Howard and his clouds. The thought of spending years writing a book, you know, polishing your sentences, making them sing, for it then just to be read by a handful of specialists who write annoyed little comments in the margin. And it might get reviewed 5 years later, bad-temperedly, in some academic journal. That felt very dispiriting indeed. And another thing as well, and this is purely my good fortune of timing, something had recently happened to completely transform the publishing landscape. And that was the surprise success of Davis O'Bell's book, Longitude. That came out at the end of 1995. And I know quite a lot of publishers, and they were completely baffled by what happened next. It became, largely through word of mouth, the biggest publishing sensation of 1996. Within a few months, it had sold more than a million copies in hardback, largely by word of mouth. It completely transformed and overturned what publishers thought they knew about the behaviour of the book-buying public. Here was a book about 18th century horology, written by an unknown author, that became the publishing sensation. It was then turned into a big budget miniseries starring Michael Gambon and Jeremy Irons, who doesn't move his top lip. You know, it's 2 hours long and he doesn't move his top lip once. Jeremy Irons. Publishers were very perturbed by this. You know, it didn't make any sense. But I was very interested because I'd done a PhD in 18th century history of science, and I was casting about for a book idea. This made a big impression on me, and I spent a lot of time thinking about why it had been such a success, and in the end I decided that it was the subtitle of Longitude, how a lone scientific genius solved the greatest scientific problem of his time. Now, put aside the fact that Harrison didn't work alone, he wasn't a genius, and he didn't solve a scientific problem. The science was known. The answer was known. What he did was very doggedly and brilliantly, over a 40-year period, solve a particular technical problem in the craft of clockmaking, so that he designed a clock that kept accurate time at sea, so that the problem of longitude, where a ship knowing where it was solved. Aside from all of that, what this subtitle offers is a heroic story of quest, romance, adventure. It's like a novel, and the book does read like a novel. It tells a very good story, and it tells it very well. And people felt that they were learning something, they were getting something interesting about the past, but they were also getting a really good story. a story about triumphing over his adversity. Here's John Harrison, a humble clockmaker who eventually triumphs over his aristocratic detractors and rivals and bears the prize away. It's a fantastic story arc. And I'd read a lot of popular works of history of science, and I noticed that all of Fermat's Last Theorem by Simon Singh, or Paul Strathern's book on Mendeleev's Dream about the creation of the periodic table of the elements, all of them had something in common, which is a strong and interesting central character who you follow their story, and they have interesting lives, they do interesting things, and the rest of it. But the key thing is, and this is true of television documentaries about science as well, you can follow the story even if you can't follow the science. That's really important. That's important for TV, that there has to be a story that the audience can follow. Even if they don't understand string theory, they can look at the guy with strange hair walking over the mountain, because that's a story. And it didn't take me very long in the British Library to work out that that's exactly what I found in Luke Howard. I found an interesting central character who could act as a kind of emissary for the reader, taking them through fairly unfamiliar terrain. But so there were lots of things I wanted to talk about in the book, lots of ideas and events to do with the history of meteorology, the history of nephology particularly, the study of clouds. And there were lots of interesting people in the margins, Humphrey Davy, Coleridge, Wordsworth, Lamarck, Dalton, lots of interesting people of the time who Howard had a connection with. But at the centre of all of this was the figure of Howard, who would be the reader's identification as you went through the book. And that was really how the book came about. Now, the success of Longitude did not make my book any easier to read, to write. It did make it a more straightforward pitch to publishers, though. Basically, if you like Longitude, you'll like this. That's how publishers work. Have a look at the covers of any best-selling book, and it'll look like the cover of another best-selling book. It's called Me Too Publishing, and there's a lot of it about. So all of this revolved around Howard, and the narratively useful fact that he lived a very long life. He lived into his 92nd year. So you have this lovely, long, nearly a century life in which meteorology changed from a speculative hobby to a credible modern science in the course of this lifetime. And, of course, he had much to do with that transformation. And those are the two stories I wanted to tell in the book, the story of Luke Howard and the story of the rise of meteorology as a modern science. And it turned out, also, the story of clouds themselves. And that was a story that I didn't know yet that I was interested in. So, I mentioned earlier Howard's classification of clouds was based on a simple but penetrating idea. And I'll kind of go over that. I've got this Met Office graphic. I do love the Met Office and their pedantic yet charming public pronouncement. I love the fact that you have these pronunciations. That's kind of interesting because I think certainly when Howard came up with the terms in 1802, people did have a problem with the pronunciation, and he did have to produce pronunciation prompts, because we think that everybody then spoke Latin, but they didn't. Most people had not a clue of Latin. A very small number of people. And in fact, the Latin that they did learn didn't make them fluent. They all tended to learn the same few bits, the same three lines from Ovid, the book four of the Georgics. There was a national curriculum, as it were. And as long as they were all quoting the same bits, they were fine. You see, when you got somebody quoting the bit of Ovid they didn't know, people were going, huh? Kind of interesting. But what I think this is wonderfully misguided is that I don't think you really need the pronunciation guide. People aren't worried about how to pronounce them, they're worried about what they mean, I think. Which is a kind of, it's a social history in itself. So the wonderful thing about Howard's classification was that it allowed for the transformation of clouds, for the way the clouds move one into the other. He had, as I mentioned, as I showed in the previous slide, the three main families of cloud: stratus, cumulus, as we're supposed to pronounce it, and cirrus at the top. The three main cloud types, three sort of familial types. Now, a cumulus cloud might rise and spread and turn into a stratocumulus, or a cirrus cloud might descend and spread and turn into a cirrocumulus, or a stratocumulus might rise even further and begin to break up and turn into an altocumulus. And there was this relationship between all the cloud types. This was really Howard's big idea, his big observation. All the clouds existed in relation to each other. What he really understood about the atmosphere and about clouds was that they were systems. No one had grasped this before. There had been attempts to name the clouds before. Lamarck, only a couple of years before, the French natural philosopher, had attempted to name certain cloud varieties, but he hadn't really got very far for lots of reasons, mainly because he didn't grasp the relationship of one cloud to another. So you have this very clever system by which clouds can be named as even as they change. It's a dynamic system. It's a classification which doesn't try to freeze frame the sky, but allows it to keep moving, to keep modifying, to keep its essential mutability. It recognizes its essential mutability, its changefulness. Now, this concept of mutability in the Romantic era is absolutely central. Now, most Romantic poets at some point wrote a poem called Mutability, or it had mutability in the title, or it had mutability in the first line. This absolutely key concept of sort of Romantic literature, Romantic art. Mutability, kind of a fundamental disposition to change. That the universe, people, human relations, the natural world, the cosmos, everything in it is subject to essential change. Nothing stays the same, nothing remains still. And this was a problem with a lot of natural history classification, is that it was fixed, it appeared fixed. And what Howard's classification did was it allowed you to track these changes. It allowed you to witness one cloud transforming, transitioning into another cloud. And you could name that transition, you could name that process. It recognized that clouds were processes and systems, not fixed, static entities. A lot of his Romantic era contemporaries were really interested and impressed by this. And Goethe, in particular, thought Howard was absolutely the bee's knees. I mean, Goethe had a long-standing interest in weather and meteorology and morphology, what he called this, the study of form and shape. And he had this motto, which was that there is never a moment in nature where nothing can be said to be happening. It's a really nice idea. It expresses this idea of mutability very clearly. And he wrote to Howard and asked Howard to send him some biographical details, which he did. And Goethe was so impressed by Howard's sort of modesty, his Quaker lifestyle, and Howard's letter is very sweet. It talks about how he prefers to hang around with his family and, you know, seek fame abroad and all that stuff, which are kind of tropes in themselves, but they were nicely expressed. And Goethe wrote a poem in honour of Howard. That's the title. Howard's Eric. No, I can't read the German. But it was translated for Howard. And I won't read the whole thing, but the last stanza. He's spoken before about how clouds were completely unknown, unknowable, you know, just images of doubt and uncertainty. And then along came Howard, according to Goethe. But Howard gives us, with his clearer mind, the gain of lessons new to all mankind, that which no hand can reach, no hand can clasp. He first has gained, first held with mental grasp, defined the doubtful, fixed its limit line, and named it fitly, be the honour thine. As clouds ascend, are folded, scatter, fall, let the world think of thee, who taught it all. And not only that, but Goethe wrote some accompanying commentary to the poem. Poets, you know, you can trust a scientist poet to write a poem and then write a commentary on his own poem. Very interesting commentary, as you can imagine. I won't read the whole thing, just the end of it, where he says about that last stanza that I've just read out, this very nomenclature is intimated and announced in the penultimate line of the introduction as follows. As clouds ascend, stratus, says Goethe, are folded, cumulus, scatter, cirrus, fall, nimbus. He's intimating the cloud system in the form of a poem. Even more interestingly is Shelley's response. Again, Shelley's The Cloud. Now, Shelley wrote two poems, actually. I'm going to talk about both of them. He wrote very famously a poem called Mutability in 1814, which starts, and most poets who invoked mutability also invoked the clouds because they're such an obvious image of changeability, you know, of frustrating your attempts to witness them, to, you know, to talk about them. There's a wonderful scene in Antony and Cleopatra where Antony is in despair outside his tent and he points up and says, you know, if I tell you that cloud is dragonish and you look up, by the time you look up, you can tell me, yes, there's a cloud, but it no longer looks like a dragon. You know, it's this kind of interesting thing with clouds. They change so fast that they can't, that they're not amenable, really, to accurate observation. This is something that bedevils the Met Office to this day, that the atmospheric system moves so fast. And, of course, we're inside the system, but it's incredibly hard to track changes. And all that the... I'm completely distracting myself here, but... meteorology is, right from the beginning, has attempted to be a science of the future tense. There's been an attempt to be able to predict. But the problem is, in order to predict something happening in the future, you have to know what's happening now. And if what's happening now is unbelievably complex and difficult to grasp, which it is, then that completely shackles one's attempts to predict. That's basically what Met Office spends billions on doing, trying to describe what's happening right now. It sounds like I've got something in for the Met Office. I haven't. I have very cordial relations with the Met Office. Anyway, Shelley, Mutability begins. We are as clouds that veil the midnight moon. How restlessly they speed and gleam and quiver. Streaking the darkness radiantly, yet soon night closes round, and they are lost forever. Not so. Now, the interesting thing is that by 1820, he's read Howard. Howard's first edition of Howard's Climate of London, which was his sort of big book, his bestseller, as it were, had began with his essay on the modifications of clouds. It's where most people read the essay. Although the essay had come out in a philosophical magazine, it had been printed by itself as well. Where most people got hold of it was in the 1818 Climate of London, and that's when you start seeing people like Constable, Shelley, Wordsworth and so on responding directly to Howard's, to Howard's ideas. So by the time Shelley came to write The Cloud in 1820, he changed his mind about clouds being lost forever, because of course they're not. And he writes this cloud. It's a very long poem, I won't read it all. But I wanted just to bring your attention to some particular lines, because what Shelley does is go through Howard's entire cloud classification one by one. It's something that Goethe did as well. And this is very interesting. So it starts, "I bring fresh showers for the thirsting flowers, from the seas and the streams. I bear light shade for the leaves when laid in their noonday dreams." He's having a go at cumulus there. "From my wings are shaken the dews that waken the sweet buds every one, when rocked to rest on their mother's breast as she dances about the sun." Stratus. I wield the flail of the lashing hail and whiten the green plains under. And then again, as I dissolve it in rain, I laugh as I pass in thunder." Obviously, thundercloud. "That orbed maiden with white fire laden, whom mortals call the moon, glides glimmering o'er my fleece-like floor, by the midnight breezes strewn." Can you guess? Cirrus. Oh, my shadow can't quite reach there. While I widen the rent in my wind-built tent, till the calm rivers, lakes, and seas, like strips of the sky fallen through me on high, are each paved with the moon and leaves." Oops, sorry. Clearly, either Cirrostratus or Cirrocumulus, which you get those wonderful lunar halos through the ice crystal formations. Shall I go on? I bind the sun's throne with a burning zone and the moon's with a girdle of pearl. Volcanoes are dim and the stars wheel and swim. When the whirlwinds my banner unfurl." Again, this is going to be either Cirrocumulus or Cirrostratus, these ice crystal clouds that create these wonderful lunar and solar halos and rainbows and so on. I just wanted to read the very last stanza of the poem because, you know, he's clearly changed his mind about clouds. "I am the daughter of earth and water and the nursling of the sky. I pass through the pores of the ocean and shores. I change, but I cannot die." Interesting. He's moved on from lost forever to "I change, but I cannot die." That's very important. "I change, but I cannot die." That is true. And what's interesting, he goes on, I won't read any more. But this is interesting because here are sort of the greatest artistic minds of their generation. Constable, Goethe, Shelley, responding and creating artworks that they don't just respond to current scientific and recent scientific ideas. They actually explain them, or at least they have a go at getting inside them and saying why they're interesting and important. And that line of Shelley's, "I change but I cannot die," is a very profound statement to make about atmospheric processes, because it suggests a kind of energy budget that is not extinguished. It's just things are moved around, but they're not extinguished. It's a very powerful, interesting thing to have said, I think. And that part of the book I found most exciting to write, when you realise that what appeared to be a very kind of minor episode in the history of science turned out to be, in some ways, a quiet revolution in human consciousness. If I said that on TV, there'd be a little drum roll. Anyway, another of the great pleasures of doing and frustrations, I must say, of doing the research, was discovering Luke Howard's own sketchbooks. Now, he was clearly an amateur artist. But he did dozens and dozens of watercolour sketches of clouds. The ones with the landscapes in are kind of interesting. I found a whole lot of receipts that he paid a jobbing landscape painter called Edward Kenyon to prepare some blank pieces of drawing paper with, you know, nicely done landscapes, so that Howard could then add the clouds onto them. I think it's quite common practice at the time. And he was a very keen amateur draftsman, but a very good observer, a very fine observer indeed. I particularly like the mountain stratus thing, which he did on holiday in the Lake District. And this Cirrus in parallel, it's at the top. If you saw the poster outside, which I must say I was slightly taken aback by. There's a poster on the outside of the building. But the cloud over Oxford last week or the week before was a very fine display of this cirrus vibratus cloud, one of Howard's favourites. And also I discovered that Howard was an ancestor of the painter Howard Hodgkin, who in fact Howard Hodgkin is named after his famous ancestor Luke Howard. And this is another of those Edward Kenyon landscapes with a Howard cloud on top over there. And I thought there's a nice circularity of relationship between Howard, Constable and Hodgkin, because obviously Howard does his cloud paintings and stuff, and Constable does his cloud studies in response to Luke Howard's work. And Howard Hodgkin produced an album called For John Constable. This is a print, actually, after Luke Howard. So it's kind of circularity. I love this painting, a recent Howard Hodgkin snow cloud, which, interesting comparison to Luke Howard's snowy cumulus in the top left, almost exactly 200 years before. It's kind of an interesting relationship between these three personalities, very, very different indeed personalities. If anyone's ever run into Howard Hodgkin, you'll know what I mean. All of Luke Howard's watercolours are held by the Science Museum in London, but you'll never see them because they're kept locked in a vault in the repository of Live House Olympia, which I find very upsetting, actually. You have to make an appointment with the curator to go and see them. It's not particularly easy to get to, and there's this fantastic prison door which slams behind you. It's like the opening credits of Porridge. But I've had several conversations with the Science Museum about why can't you show some of Howard's watercolours, because they do have a small display about Howard. They've got his rain gauge and all the things. A nice enough rain gauge, an interesting rain gauge. It's custom made for him by the Knight Brothers of Foster Lane, ironmongers and philosophical instrument makers in 1818, made to Luke Howard's design. And it's one of the first modern rain gauges. And it was buried up to just halfway up the funnel. So they've got the funnel sticking out to reduce splashback. And then at regular intervals, every day, the contents of the funnel was taken off the neck, and the contents of the glass jar was then poured into a tall cylinder which had very fine calibrations down the side in hundredths of an inch, and Howard came up with this design. But my kind of beef with the Science Museum is that this object tells a story, but so do these wonderful watercolours. Why can't they be shown together? And something that's been said to me twice now is, well, we're not an art gallery, which is true, but that raises the question of what the status, the relative status of these objects is. I mean, if we're saying that a rain gauge is a scientific object, but a series of annotated watercolours made by a notable scientist are not scientific objects, surely that's Philistine in both directions. It's Philistine about science as well as being Philistine about art. But it also kind of goes to the heart of a lot of my research interest, which is the fruitful overlap, collaboration, and indeed sort of thematic conjunctions of the arts and the sciences, how they come out with the same kinds of inquiries. And to separate them off in that way, I think is a missed opportunity. I know that there are curatorial, I'm sure Stephen will tell me, lots of curatorial reasons why watercolours are not easy to display. But it's this, it's not so much that, it's the category distinction. We're not an art gallery. It's kind of it makes me feel uneasy. And it's much easier to display objects than it is to display ideas. But what I think about the relative status of this, which is, as I said, nothing against the rain gauge, it's an interesting rain gauge. but I think that what the images do make a direct visual appeal. And they kind of tell a visual story. They make a visual argument about cloud classification and modification and Howard's relationship to them in a way that Howard's rain gauge doesn't quite do. It tells a different story, or it tells the same story as well. I'm not sure. This seems like a slightly heretical thing to be saying in a room full of scientific objects. But I think that the Atmospheres exhibition that's currently on here overcomes this very well. It's got a very good mixture of image, object, idea. Not too much explanation, but enough to make the images come to life. And there are certain objects, like in this room, that tell their own story. Like the jars on the far wall, I think, make a fantastic visual argument for what people felt about pharmacology in whatever it was, 1700, thereabouts. All that wonderful lodestone with the crown. It's just like, you know, one of the maddest objects in the museum, isn't it? But it tells, it's so visually eloquent about, you know, what its purpose was, what it meant at the time. And I think that often science museums, not this one, because it's not a science museum, but the Science Museum in London, I think, often misses a trick about how to display ideas, how to make the objects that it has come to life, because science isn't about objects, it's about ideas. Yeah. And one of the great things about Howard's cloud classification, this is one of the things that Goethe particularly liked about it, was that he didn't use any instruments at all in making his classification. In fact, between you and me, Howard's instruments were completely useless in a modern sense. His thermometer at Plasto was under a laurel bush, and his thermometer at Tottenham was a metre up high off the wall on the north wall. You know, so it was all of the readings you can more or less discount, because they're not really credibly comparable. Yet his cloud classification, cloud nomenclature, was calibrated perfectly, because he didn't use any instruments. Completely observational, linguistic, and conceptual. And that's what Goethe really praised about it. He said, you know, a scientist who attends to his instruments, a meteorologist who attends to his instruments only, is attending only to the pulse of the atmosphere and leaving the corpse, or whatever it is, from over to die. It's quite an interesting comment. So, images, objects, and ideas. Have we got, how am I doing for time? We've got. Can I say one more thing? Can I say two more things? How many more things can I say? There was one thing I wanted to say, which was that Howard lived long enough to see the advent of the professionalisation of meteorology. It was something that he had brought about himself in his own lifetime. Now, I wrote that at the end of the book, and sort of, you know, the end, thanks for coming kind of thing at the end. And I thought that was kind of the end of the story, but I was wrong, because what I hadn't really borne in mind was the extent and the interest of Howard's living descendants in his story and in the kind of what one might call the legacy of Luke Howard. Are there any of Howard's descendants here? They're all really nice. But several weeks after the book came out and was reviewed, I got a very irate letter from a direct descendant of Howard who said, you've upset me and the family very much by saying that he's buried in an unmarked grave in Winchmore Hill. Because My family and I have been paying for the upkeep of his grave in Abbey Park Cemetery, Stoke Newington, for the last 50 years. And this obviously, I was very upset. And I wrote back and said, I'm very sorry if I've caused you any concern or upset. And obviously I'll look into this immediately. But in the meantime, may I just say that, I had at the time of writing every confidence that he is indeed buried in an unmarked grave in Winchmore Hill, because A, the obituaries said so, and B, I've seen the graveyard plans in the archive of Friends House, Winchmore Hill, and there's his grave. I knew that there had been a plot bought in Stoke Newington at a time when Luke Howard had fallen out with the Society of Friends, Quakers. We all think of the Quakers as being very peaceful, which they are, but they're also very passionate. And there was a big dispute in the 1850s, 40s, I think, called the Beacon Controversy, which I won't go into. But suffice to say, Luke Howard left the Society of Friends in high dudgeon and joined the Plymouth Brethren. And one of the consequences of that was that he bought a plot, a family plot, in this dissenting graveyard in Stoke Newington, and saying that he wasn't going to be buried in a Quaker graveyard. Now, obviously, by the time Howard died, this dispute had been long forgotten, and Howard was clearly forgiven and welcomed back in the fold, because he was buried in Winchmore Hill. And a week later, I got a very contrite letter from this man saying, "I'm very sorry, you're quite right. He is buried in Winchmore Hill," which means that I've been paying my respect to the wrong grave for 50 years. there are some Howards in that family plot in Stoke Newington. It's just that Luke Howard was very much in Winchmore Hill. Now, interestingly enough, last year, 2011, the grave of Luke Howard's wife, Mariabella, was discovered, lying face down, holding up a notice board as these things happened. And it was decided that it would be recut, rededicated, and have Luke Howard's name inscribed onto it, as well as his wife, Mariabella. And there was a very moving ceremony at Friend's House, Winchmore Hill, which was filmed by Songs of Praise. And they had a particular episode about weather, and it was filled with weather psalms and hymns and so on. It was really nice. And that was that. And I think that Howard would have approved of that, actually being a devout Quaker and a good Christian, as he thought himself. The blue plaque was a long story, which I won't go into, but I got involved in the blue plaque application, which was much more annoying and bureaucratic than you can possibly imagine, involving many organisations and people who didn't want it to happen, whose job it was to happen. And the wording of the plaque took so many meetings A Namer of Clouds was a kind of, as you can tell, it's a kind of compromise, because it doesn't sound like a proper English sentence. it's a sentence dreamed up by a committee, and it's exactly what it is. But I quite like it now. I think Namer of Clouds is about right. I think Howard would like that as well. Have I got time to say one more thing? one more thing, really, really quick, which is that The cloud classification is a mutable thing in itself, which it was always intended to be. There are at present 10 cloud genera, that is to say the main types of cloud, cirrus, cumulus, stratus, cumulonimbus, stratocumulus, etc. There are 14 species, which is things like fibratus. These are mostly descriptive terms. There are also 9 varieties. Okay, genera, species, all very Linnaean. And the varietal names tend to describe texture or the effect on light of a particular cloud. So terms like translucidus, opacus, floccus, that kind of thing. Does it sound like I'm talking gibberish? I always feel like I'm talking gibberish. And the last, and these terms have been added over the years and decades. Now, the most recent term to be added was in tortoise in 1951, which means twisted, and is usually applied to cirrus clouds. In fact, exactly the kind of cirrus cloud that's on the poster outside, cirrus fibratus in tortoise, means, you know, a fibrous, twisted form of cirrus. It is quite self-explanatory in some ways, the Latin. But there is a new kid on the block, which is Aspiratus, which has yet to be, it's been put to the World Meteorological Organization by a committee of whom Gavin Preter-Pinney of the Cloud Appreciation Society, who really came up with the term Aspiratus. It's Latin for roughened. And in fact, Virgil used it in a poem to describe a wind-roughened sea. And it means exactly that. And when this idea was put, when Gavin Preter-Pinney went to the Royal Meteorological Society with this idea to put a new term to the WMO, got quite a lot of press attention. It was in 2009 or 10, and there's a lot of stories saying new cloud discovered, which it wasn't quite as dramatic as that. It's not a new type of cloud. It's a proposed new descriptive term to add to the vocabulary available. Not quite the same thing as a new cloud, but, you know, journalism. And it really is to describe this particular kind of cloud, which you don't see very often. It's quite rare. You get it after very stormy weather. And you get this kind of turbulent underbase of a passing cumulonimbus, or in this case, a stratocumulus. Gives low-lying clouds, and it gets kind of weird silvery light. And when I did the for the Met Office, I rewrote their cloud observer's guide for them, and I followed very carefully the World Meteorological Organization's cloud categories when I did it. And the reason that I then had to do a sequel was because I found so many clouds that didn't fit the classification. That's a problem with classifications, is that they're partial. And one of the clouds that I, of course, found was this, which didn't yet have a name, because this came out before, which was, you can see, it's pretty much the same. There's silvery ripples. And the text that I put was, "What are these clouds?" because, it was really fun. This image in particular, I telephoned the photographer. I had a lot of trouble with this particular book because a lot of the clouds are very outlandish. It's called Extraordinary Clouds for a reason. And I had to make sure that not one of those clouds was photoshopped or altered in any way. I'm not interested in extraordinary retouching techniques. I'm interested in extraordinary weather. And I had a long chat with the photographer, Jane Wiggins, and she supplied me with lots of other photos. In fact, there's film footage of that particular incident. And this word, Aspiratus, is in a way, it's an attempt to give a name to something which as yet has no name, amazingly. That there's something visible up there in the sky that as yet has no official name. So I suppose I'd say, you know, watch this space, or rather watch that space, and thank you for listening.